Welcome to The Great Stories. I'm Trev Downey, and each week I'll read and then discuss a truly great short story by one of the iconic authors. Who doesn't enjoy being told a tale? Humans have been telling each other yarns as long as language itself has existed. Stories to entertain, to inspire, to frighten, and to teach. On this podcast, there will be no academic elitism. We will focus only on the story you'll be told, the context in which it appeared, and the author responsible for its creation. The Great Stories, you see, is for everyone. So, gather round, and let's enjoy this episode's tale. This blind man, an old friend of my wife's, he was on his way to spend the night. His wife had died, so he was visiting the dead wife's relatives in Connecticut. He called my wife from his in-laws. Arrangements were made. He would come by train, a 5-hour trip, and my wife would meet him at the station. She hadn't seen him since she worked for him one summer in Seattle, 10 years ago. But she and the blind man had kept in touch. They made tapes and mailed them back and forth. I wasn't enthusiastic about his visit. He was no one I knew, and his being blind bothered me. My idea of blindness came from the movies. In the movies, the blind moved slowly and never laughed. Sometimes they were led by seeing-eye dogs. A blind man in my house was not something I looked forward to. That summer in Seattle, she had needed a job. She didn't have any money. The man she was going to marry at the end of the summer was in officers' training school. He didn't have any money either. But she was in love with the guy, and he was in love with her, etc. She'd seen something in the paper, help wanted, referring to the blind man, and a telephone number. She phoned and went over, was hired on the spot. She worked with this blind man all summer. She read stuff to him, case studies, reports, that sort of thing. She helped him organize his little office in the county social service department. They'd become good friends, my wife and the blind man. On her last day in the office, the blind man asked if he could touch her face. She agreed to this. She told me he touched his fingers to every part of her face, her nose, even her neck. She never forgot it. She even tried to write a poem about it. She was always trying to write a poem. She wrote a poem every 2 years, usually after something really important had happened to her. When we first started going out together, she showed me the poem. In the poem, she recalled his fingers and the way they had moved around over her face. In the poem, she talked about what she had felt at the time, about what went through her mind when the blind man touched her nose and lips. I can remember I didn't think much of the poem. Of course, I didn't tell her that. Maybe I just don't understand poetry. I admit it's not the first thing I reach for when I pick up something to read. Anyway, this man who'd first enjoyed her favors, this officer-to-be, he'd been her childhood sweetheart. So, okay, I'm saying that at the end of the summer she let the blind man run his hands over her face, said goodbye to him, married her childhood, etc., who was now a commissioned officer, and she moved away from Seattle. But they'd keep in touch, she and the blind man. She made the first contact after a year or so. She called him up one night from an Air Force base in Alabama. She wanted to talk. They talked. He asked her to send him a tape and tell him about her life. She did this. She sent the tape. On the tape, she told the blind man she loved her husband, but she didn't like it where they lived, and she didn't like it that he was part of the military-industrial thing. She told the blind man she'd written a poem and he was in it. She told him that she was writing a poem about what it was like to be an Air Force officer's wife. The poem wasn't finished yet. She was still writing it. The blind man made a tape. He sent her the tape. She made a tape. This went on for years. My wife's officer was posted to one base and then another. She sent tapes from Moody Air Force Base, McGuire, McConnell, and finally Travis near Sacramento, where one night she got to feeling lonely and cut off from people she kept losing in that moving around life. She got to feeling she couldn't go at another step. She went in and swallowed all the pills and capsules in the medicine chest and washed them down with a bottle of gin. Then she got into a hot bath and passed out. But instead of dying, she got sick. She threw up. Her officer, why should he have a name? He was the childhood sweetheart, and what more does he want? Came home from somewhere, found her, and called the ambulance. In time, she put it all on tape and sent the tape to the blind man. Over the years, she put all kinds of stuff on tapes and sent the tapes off lickety-split. Next to writing a poem every year, I think it was her chief means of recreation. On one tape, she told the blind man she decided to live away from her officer for a time. On another tape, she told him about her divorce. She and I began going out, and of course, she told her blind man about it. She told him everything, or so it seemed to me. Once she asked me if I'd like to hear the latest tape from the blind man. This was a year ago. I was on the tape, she said. So I said okay, I'd listen to it. I got us drinks and we settled down in the living room. We made ready to listen. First, she inserted the tape into the player and adjusted a couple of dials. Then she pushed a lever. The tape squeaked and someone began to talk in this loud voice. She lowered the volume. After a few minutes of harmless chit-chat, I heard my own name in the mouth of this stranger, this blind man I didn't even know. And then this. From all you've said about him, I can only conclude. But we were interrupted. A knock at the door or something, and we didn't ever get back to the tape. Maybe it was just as well. I'd heard all I wanted to. Now this same blind man was coming over to sleep in my house. Maybe I could take him bowling, I said to my wife. She was at the draining board, doing scalloped potatoes. She put down the knife she was using and turned around. If you love me, she said, you can do this for me. If you don't love me, okay. But if you had a friend, any friend, and the friend came to visit, I'd make him feel comfortable. She wiped her hands with the dish towel. I don't have any blind friends, I said. You don't have any friends, she said. Period. Besides, she said, God damn it, his wife's just died. Don't you understand that? The man's lost his wife. I didn't answer. She told me a little about the blind man's wife. Her name was Beulah. Beulah. That's a name for a colored woman. Was his wife a Negro? I asked. Are you crazy? My wife said. Have you just flipped or something? She picked up a potato. I saw it hit the floor and then roll under the stove. What's wrong with you? She said. Are you drunk? I'm just asking, I said. Right then my wife filled me with more detail than I cared to know. I made a drink and sat at the kitchen table to listen. Pieces of the story began to fall into place. Beulah had gone to work for the blind man the summer after my wife had stopped working for him. Pretty soon Beulah and the blind man had themselves a church wedding. It was a little wedding. Who'd want to go to such a wedding in the first place? Just the two of them, plus the minister and the minister's wife. But it was a church wedding just the same. It was what Beulah had wanted, he'd said. But even then, Beulah must have been carrying the cancer in her glands. After they'd been inseparable for 8 years, my wife's word, inseparable, Beulah's health went into a rapid decline. She died in a Seattle hospital room, the blind man sitting beside the bed and holding on to her hand. They'd married, lived, and worked together, slept together, had sex, sure. And then the blind man had to bury her. All this without ever having seen what the goddamned woman looked like. It was beyond my understanding. Hearing this, I felt sorry for the blind man for a little bit. And then I found myself thinking what a pitiful life this woman must have led. Imagine a woman who could never see herself as she was seen in the eyes of her loved one. A woman who could go on day after day and never receive the smallest compliment from her beloved. A woman whose husband could never read the expression on her face, be it misery or something better. Someone who could wear makeup or not. What difference to him? She could, if she wanted, wear green eyeshadow around one eye, a straight pin in her nostril, yellow slacks and purple shoes. No matter. And then slip off into death. The blind man's hand on her hand. His blind eyes streaming tears. I'm imagining now. Her last thought may be this. That he never even knew what she looked like. And she on an express to the grave. Robert was left with the small insurance policy and half of a 20 peso Mexican coin. The other half of the coin went into the box with her. Pathetic. So when the time rolled round, my wife went to the depot to pick him up, with nothing to do but wait. Sure, I blamed him for that. I was having a drink and watching the TV when I heard the car pull into the drive. I got up from the sofa with my drink and went to the window to have a look. I saw my wife laughing as she parked the car. I saw her get out of the car and shut the door. She was still wearing a smile. Just amazing. She went around to the other side of the car to where the blind man was already starting to get out. This blind man, feature this, he was wearing a full beard. A beard on a blind man. Too much, I say. The blind man reached into the back seat and dragged out a suitcase. My wife took his arm, shut the car door, and, talking all the way, moved him down the drive and then up the steps to the front porch. I turned off the TV, I finished my drink, rinsed the glass, dried my hands, then I went to the door. My wife said, "I want you to meet Robert. Robert, this is my husband, I've told you all about him." She was beaming. She had this blind man by his coat sleeve. The blind man let go of his suitcase and up came his hand. I took it. He squeezed hard, held my hand, and then he let it go. "I feel like we've already met," he boomed. "Likewise," I said. I didn't know what else to say. Then I said, "Welcome. I've heard a lot about you." We began to move then, a little group, from the porch into the living room, my wife guiding him by the arm. The blind man was carrying his suitcase in the other hand. My wife said things like, "To your left here, Robert, that's right. Now watch it, there's a chair, that's it. Sit down right there. This is the sofa. We just bought this sofa 2 weeks ago." I started to say something about the old sofa. I like that old sofa. But I didn't say anything. Then I wanted to say something else, small talk about the scenic ride along the Hudson, how going to New York you should sit on the right-hand side of the train, and coming from New York the left-hand side. "Did you have a good train ride?" I said. "Which side of the train did you sit on, by the way?" "What a question, which side?" my wife said. "What's it matter which side?" she said. "I just asked," I said. "Right side," the blind man said. "I hadn't been on a train in nearly 40 years, not since I was a kid with my folks. That's been a long time. I'd nearly forgotten the sensation. I have winter in my beard now," he said. "So I've been told, anyway. Do I look distinguished, my dear?" the blind man said to my wife. "You look distinguished, Robert," she said. "Robert," she said. "Robert, it's just so good to see you." My wife finally took her eyes off the blind man and looked at me. I had the feeling she didn't like what she saw. I shrugged. I've never met or personally known anyone who was blind. This blind man was late 40s. A heavy-set balding man with stooped shoulders, as if he carried a great weight there. He wore brown slacks, brown shoes, a light brown shirt, a tie, a sports coat. Spiffy. He also had this full beard, but he didn't use a cane, and he didn't wear dark glasses. I'd always thought dark glasses were a must for the blind. Fact was, I wish he had a pair. At first glance, his eyes looked like anyone else's eyes, but if you looked close, there was something different about them. Too much white in the iris, for one thing, and the pupils seemed to move around in the sockets without his knowing it or being able to stop it. Creepy. As I stared at his face, I saw the left pupil turn in towards his nose, while the other made an effort to keep in one place. But it was only an effort, for that one eye was on the roam without his knowing it, or wanting it to be. I said, "Let me get you a drink. What's your pleasure? We have a little bit of everything. It's one of our pastimes." "Bob, I'm a Scotchman myself," he said, fast enough in this big voice. "Right," I said. pub. Sure you are. I knew it. He let his fingers touch his suitcase, which was sitting alongside the sofa. He was taking his bearings. I didn't blame him for that. I'll move that up to your room, my wife said. No, that's fine, the blind man said loudly. It can go up when I go up. A little water with the scotch, I said. Very little, he said. I knew it, I said. He said, just a tad. The Irish actor, Barry Fitzgerald? I'm like that fellow. When I drink water, Fitzgerald said, I drink water. When I drink whiskey, I drink whiskey. My wife laughed. The blind man brought his hand up under his beard. He lifted his beard slowly and let it drop. I did the drinks, 3 big glasses of scotch with a splash of water in each. Then we made ourselves comfortable and talked about Robert's travels. From the long flight from the west coast to Connecticut, we covered that. Then from Connecticut up here by train, we had another drink concerning that leg of the trip. I remembered having read somewhere that the blind didn't smoke because, as speculation had it, they couldn't see the smoke they exhaled. I thought I knew that much and that much only about blind people, but this blind man smoked his cigarette down to the nubbin and then lit another one. This blind man filled his ashtray and my wife emptied it. When we sat down at the table for dinner, we had another drink. My wife heaped Robert's plate with cube steak, scalloped potatoes, green beans. I buttered him up 2 slices of bread. I said, here's bread and butter for you. I swallowed some of my drink. Now, let us pray, I said, and the blind man lowered his head. My wife looked at me, her mouth agape. Pray the phone won't ring and the food doesn't get cold, I said. We dug in. We ate everything there was to eat on the table. We ate like there was no tomorrow. We didn't talk. We ate. We scarfed. We grazed the table. We were into serious eating. The blind man had right away located his foods. He knew just where everything was on his plate. I watched with admiration as he used his knife and fork on the meat. He'd cut 2 pieces of the meat, fork the meat into his mouth, and then go all out for the scalloped potatoes, the beans next, and then he'd tear off a hunk of buttered bread and eat that. He'd follow this up with a big drink of milk. It didn't seem to bother him to use his fingers once in a while either. We finished everything, including half a strawberry pie. For a few moments we sat as if stunned, sweat beaded on our faces. Finally, we got up from the table and left the dirty plates. We didn't look back. We took ourselves into the living room and sank into our places again. Robert and my wife sat on the sofa. I took the big chair. We had us 2 or 3 more drinks while they talked about the major things that had come to pass for them in the past 10 years. For the most part, I just listened. Now and then I joined in. I didn't want him to think I'd left the room, and I didn't want her to think I was feeling left out. They talked of things that had happened to them, these past 10 years. I waited in vain to hear my name on my wife's sweet lips. And then my dear husband came into my life, something like that. But I heard nothing of the sort. More talk of Robert. Robert had done a little of everything, it seemed. A regular blind jack of all trades. But most recently, he and his wife had had an Amway distributorship, from which I gathered they'd earned a living, such as it was. The blind man was also a ham radio operator. He talked in his loud voice about conversations he'd had with fellow operators in Guam, in the Philippines, in Alaska, and even in Tahiti. He said he'd have a lot of friends there if he ever wanted to go visit those places. From time to time he'd turn his blind face toward me, put his hand under his beard, ask me something. How long had I been in my present position? 3 years. Did I like my work? I didn't. Was I going to stay with it? What were the options? Finally, when I thought he was beginning to run down, I got up and turned on the TV. My wife looked at me with irritation. She was heading toward a boil. Then she looked at the blind man and said, Robert, do you have a TV? The blind man said, my dear, I have 2 TVs. I have a color set and a black and white thing, an old relic. It's funny, but if I turn the TV on, and I'm always turning it on, I turn on the color set. It's funny, don't you think? I didn't know what to say to that. I had absolutely nothing to say to that, no opinion. So I watched the news program and tried to listen to what the announcer was saying. "This is a color TV," the blind man said. "Don't ask me how I know, but I can tell. We traded up a while ago," I said. The blind man had another taste of his drink. He lifted his beard, sniffed it, and let it fall. He leaned forward on the sofa. He positioned his ashtray on the coffee table, then put the lighter to his cigarette. He leaned back on the sofa and crossed his legs at the ankles. My wife covered her mouth, and then she yawned. She stretched. She said, "I think I'll go upstairs and put on my robe. I think I'll change into something else. Robert, you make yourself comfortable," she said. "I'm comfortable," the blind man said. "I want you to feel comfortable in this house," she said. "I am comfortable," the blind man said. After she'd left the room, he and I listened to the weather report and then to the sports roundup. By that time, she'd been gone so long, I didn't know if she was going to come back. I thought she might have gone to bed. I wished she'd come back downstairs. I didn't want to be left alone with a blind man. I asked him if he wanted another drink, and he said sure. Then I asked if he wanted to smoke some dope with me. I said I'd just rolled a number. I hadn't, but I planned to do so in about 2 shakes. "I'll try some with you," he said. "Damn right," I said. "That's the stuff." I got our drinks and sat down on the sofa with him. Then I rolled us 2 fat numbers. I lit one and passed it. I brought it to his fingers. He took it and inhaled. "Hold it as long as you can," I said. I could tell he didn't know the first thing. My wife came back downstairs wearing her pink robe and her pink slippers. "What do I smell?" she said. "We thought we'd have us some cannabis," I said. My wife gave me a savage look. Then she looked at the blind man and said, "Robert, I didn't know you smoked." He said, "I do now, my dear. There's a first time for everything, but I don't feel anything yet. This stuff is pretty mellow," I said. "This stuff is mild. It's dope you can reason with," I said. "It doesn't mess you up." "Not much it doesn't, bub," he said, and laughed. My wife sat on the sofa between the blind man and me. I passed her the number. She took it and toked, and then passed it back to me. "Which way is this going?" she said. Then she said, "I shouldn't be smoking this. I can hardly keep my eyes open as it is. That dinner did me in. I shouldn't have eaten so much." "It was the strawberry pie," the blind man said. "That's what did it," he said, and he laughed his big laugh. Then he shook his head. "There's more strawberry pie," I said. "Do you want some more, Robert?" my wife said. "Maybe in a little while," he said. We gave our attention to the TV. My wife yawned again. She said, "Your bed is made up when you feel like going to bed, Robert. I know you must have had a long day. When you're ready to go to bed, say so." She pulled his arm. "Robert?" He came too and said, "I've had a real nice time. This beats tapes, doesn't it?" I said, "Coming at you." And I put the number between his fingers. He inhaled, held the smoke, and then let it go. It was like he'd been doing this since he was 9 years old. "Thanks, bub," he said. "But I think this is all for me. I think I'm beginning to feel it," he said. He held the burning roach out for my wife. "Same here," she said. "Ditto, me too." She took the roach and passed it to me. "I may just sit here for a while between you two guys with my eyes closed, but don't let me bother you, okay? Either one of you. If it bothers you, say so. Otherwise, I may just sit here with my eyes closed until you're ready to go to bed," she said. "Your bed's made up, Robert, when you're ready. It's right next to our room at the top of the stairs. We'll show you up when you're ready. You wake me up now, you guys, if I fall asleep." She said that, and then she closed her eyes and went to sleep. The news program ended. I got up and changed the channel. I sat back down on the sofa. I wished my wife hadn't pooped out. Her head lay across the back of the sofa, her mouth open. She turned so that her robe had slipped away from her legs, exposing a juicy thigh. I reached to draw her robe back over her, and it was then that I glanced at the blind man. "What the hell?" I flipped the robe open again. "You say you want some strawberry pie," I said. "I will," he said. I said, "Are you tired? Do you want me to take you up to your bed? Are you ready to hit the hay?" "Not yet," he said. No, I'll stay up with you, Bob, if that's all right. I'll stay up until you're ready to turn in. We haven't had a chance to talk. Know what I mean? I feel like me and her monopolized the evening. He lifted his beard and let it fall. He picked up his cigarettes and his lighter. That's all right, I said. Then I said, I'm glad for the company. And I guess I was. Every night I smoked dope and stayed up as long as I could before I fell asleep. My wife and I hardly ever went to bed at the same time. When I did go to sleep, I had these dreams. Sometimes I'd wake up from one of them, my heart going crazy. Something about the church in the Middle Ages was on TV. Not your run-of-the-mill TV fare. I wanted to watch something else. I turned to the other channels, but there was nothing on them either. So I turned back to the first channel and apologized. Bob, it's all right, the blind man said. It's fine with me. Whatever you want to watch is okay. I'm always learning something. Learning never ends. It won't hurt me to learn something tonight. I got ears, he said. We didn't say anything for a time. He was leaning forward with his head turned at me, his right ear aimed in the direction of the set. Very disconcerting. Now and then his eyelids drooped, and then they snapped open again. Now and then he put his fingers into his beard and tugged, like he was thinking about something he was hearing on the television. On the screen, a group of men wearing cowls was being set upon and tormented by men dressed in skeleton costumes and men dressed as devils. The men dressed as devils wore devil masks, horns, and long tails. This pageant was part of a procession. The Englishman who was narrating the thing said it took place in Spain once a year. I tried to explain to the blind man what was happening. Skeletons, he said. I know about skeletons, he said, and he nodded. The TV showed this one cathedral. Then there was a long, slow look at another one. Finally, the picture switched to the famous one in Paris with its flying buttresses and its spires reaching up to the clouds. The camera pulled away to show the whole of the cathedral rising above the skyline. There were times when the Englishman who was telling this thing would shut up, would simply let the camera move around over the cathedrals. Or else the camera would tour the countryside, men in fields walking behind oxen. I waited as long as I could. Then I felt I had to say something. I said, they're showing the outside of this cathedral now. Gargoyles, little statues carved to look like monsters. Now I guess they're in Italy? Yeah, they're in Italy. There's paintings on the walls of this one church. Are those fresco painting, Bub? He asked, and he sipped from his drink. I reached for my glass, but it was empty. I tried to remember what I could remember. You're asking me, are those frescoes? I said. That's a good question. I don't know. The camera moved to a cathedral outside Lisbon. The difference in the Portuguese cathedral compared with the French and Italian were not that great. But they were there. Mostly the interior stuff. Then something occurred to me, and I said, something has occurred to me. Do you have any idea what a cathedral is? What they look like, that is? Do you follow me? If somebody says cathedral to you, do you have any notion what they're talking about? Do you know the difference between that and a Baptist church, say? He let the smoke dribble from his mouth. I know they took hundreds of workers 50 or 100 years to build, he said. I just heard the man say that, of course. I know generations of the same families worked on a cathedral. I heard him say that too. The men who began their life's work on them. They never lived to see the completion of their work. In that wise, Bub, they're no difference from the rest of us, right? He laughed. Then his eyelids drooped again. His head nodded. He seemed to be snoozing. Maybe he was imagining himself in Portugal. The TV was showing another cathedral now. This one was in Germany. The Englishman's voice droned on. Cathedrals, the blind man said. He sat up and rolled his head back and forth. If you want the truth, Bub, that's about all I know, what I just said, what I heard him say. But maybe you could describe one to me. I wish you'd do it. I'd like that. If you want to know, I really don't have a good idea. I stared hard at the shot of the cathedral on the TV. How could I even begin to describe it? But say my life depended on it. say my life was being threatened by an insane guy who said I had to do it or else. I stared some more at the cathedral before the picture flipped off into the countryside. There was no use. I turned to the blind man and said, "To begin with, they're very tall." I was looking around the room for clues. "They reach way up, up and up, toward the sky. They're so big, some of them, that they have to have these supports to help hold them up, so to speak. These supports are called buttresses. They remind me of viaducts for some reason, but maybe you don't know viaducts either. Sometimes the cathedrals have devils and such carved into the front. Sometimes lords and ladies. Don't ask me why this is," I said. He was nodding. The whole upper part of his body seemed to be moving back and forth. "I'm not doing so good, am I?" I said. He stopped nodding and leaned forward on the edge of the sofa. As he listened to me, he was running his fingers through his beard. I wasn't getting through to him, I could see that, but he waited for me to go on just the same. He nodded like he was trying to encourage me. I tried to think what else to say. "They're really big," I said. "They're massive. They're built of stone, marble too sometimes. In those olden days when they built cathedrals, men wanted to be close to God. In those olden days, God was an important part of everyone's life. You could tell this from their cathedral building." "I'm sorry," I said, "but it looks like that's the best I can do for you. I'm just no good at it."
"That's all right, bub," the blind man said.
"Hey, listen, I hope you don't mind me asking you. Can I ask you something?" "Let me ask you a simple question, yes or no. I'm just curious, and there's no offense. You're my host, but let me ask if you are in any way religious? You don't mind my asking?" I shook my head. He couldn't see that, though. A wink is the same as a nod to a blind man. "I guess I don't believe in it. In anything. Sometimes it's hard. You know what I'm saying?"
"Sure I do," he said.
"Right," I said. The Englishman was still holding forth. My wife sighed in her sleep. She drew a long breath and went on with her sleeping. "You'll have to forgive me," I said, "but I can't tell you what a cathedral looks like. It just isn't in me to do it. I can't do any more than I've done." The blind man sat very still, his head down, as he listened to me. I said, "The truth is, cathedrals don't mean anything special to me. Nothing. Cathedrals. They're something to look at on late night TV. That's all they are." It was then that the blind man cleared his throat. He brought something up. He took a handkerchief from his back pocket. Then he said, "I get it, bub. It's okay. It happens. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it," he said. "Hey, listen to me. Will you do me a favor? I've got an idea. Why don't you find us some heavy paper and a pen? We'll do something. We'll draw one together. Get us a pen and some heavy paper. Go on, bub, get the stuff," he said. So I went upstairs. My legs felt like they didn't have any strength in them. They felt like they did after I'd done some running. In my wife's room, I looked around. I found some ballpoints in a little basket on her table, and then I tried to think where to look for the kind of paper he was talking about. Downstairs in the kitchen, I found a shopping bag with onion skins in the bottom of the bag. I emptied the bag and shook it. I brought it to the living room and sat down with it near his legs. I moved some things, smoothed the wrinkles from the bag, spread it out on the coffee table. The blind man got down from the sofa and sat next to me on the carpet. He ran his fingers over the paper. He went up and down the sides of the paper, the edges, even the edges. He fingered the corners. "All right," he said. "All right, let's do her." He found my hand, the hand with the pen. He closed his hand over my hand. "Go ahead, bub, draw," he said. "Draw, you'll see. I'll follow along with you. It'll be okay. Just begin now like I'm telling you. You'll see. Draw," the blind man said. So I began. First, I drew a box that looked like a house. It could have been the house I lived in. Then I put a roof on it. At either end of the roof, I drew spires. Crazy. "Swell," he said. "Terrific. You're doing fine," he said. "Never thought anything like this would happen in your lifetime, did you, bub? Well, it's a strange life. We all know that. Go on now, keep it up."
I put in windows with arches. I drew flying buttresses. I hung great doors. I couldn't stop. The TV station went off the air. I put down the pen and closed and opened my fingers. The blind man felt around over the paper. He moved the tips of the fingers over the paper, all over what I had drawn. And he nodded. "Doing fine," the blind man said. I took up the pen again, and he found my hand. I kept at it. I'm no artist, but I kept drawing just the same. My wife opened up her eyes and gazed at us. She sat up on the sofa, her robe hanging open. She said, "What are you doing? Tell me, I want to know." I didn't answer her. The blind man said, "We're drawing a cathedral. Me and him are working on it." "Press hard," he said to me. "That's right, that's good," he said. "Sure, you got it, Bob, I can tell. You didn't think you could, but you can, can't you? You're cooking with gas now. You know what I'm saying? We're going to really have us something here in a minute. How's the old arm?" he said. "Put some people in there now. What's a cathedral without people?" My wife said, "What's going on, Robert? What are you doing? What's going on?" "It's all right," he said to her. "Close your eyes now," the blind man said to me. I did it. I closed them, just like he said. "Are they closed?" he said. "Don't fudge." "They're closed," I said. "Keep them that way," he said. He said, "Don't stop now. Draw." So we kept on with it. His fingers rolled my fingers as my hand went over the paper. It was like nothing else in my life up to now. Then he said, "I think that's it. I think you got it," he said. "Take a look. What do you think?" But I had my eyes closed. I thought I ought to keep them that way for a little longer. I thought it was something I ought to do. "Well," he said, "are you looking?" My eyes were still closed. I was in my house, I knew that. But I didn't feel like I was inside anything. "It's really something," I said.
And that was Cathedral by Raymond Carver. We had a Carver story in the back catalogue of The Great Stories. Myself and Neil really enjoyed talking about Where I'm Calling From, which is from the same collected short stories that I got this one. Man, I love Carver. We're going to do another one again, probably within the next 10. I'm trying to convince Neb, who's our website guru, to come on board and contribute on that one. It's called Chef's House, so keep an ear out for this. But Cathedral, I think, is a much misunderstood tale. And I wouldn't blame you if, as you were listening, you were thinking, "I really dislike this guy." And that's the thing about an awful lot of Carver's central characters. They tend to be these, you know, horribly flawed individuals who are working towards some kind of insight or other, or not. In Where I'm Calling From, we had those two, you know, inherently flawed guys who were in the drying out center talking to each other about their lives, and you can't really root necessarily for them because, like I say, they are sort of inherently flawed individuals. And yet at the same time, there's a sort of a disarming honesty about them. And in the same way, I think, as the Dennis Johnson stories that we've had in the back catalog, Emergency, Work, these are stories which focus on guys, central characters, who are, you know, like I say, deeply, deeply flawed and not necessarily likable, and yet no less engaging for that. And you follow along with the narrator here, like I say, having the reactions that you should have, I think, as you go, thinking, how can someone be this ignorant? How can someone be this self-centered? Thinking his poor wife must be mortified by him, thinking, is he just one of these man-child creatures that, you know, we're all too familiar with in 2021. But there's a lot going on here. And like I say, once you get past the sort of central unlikability of our narrator and the fact that he's the one who's guiding us through this story, you get to see what a master Carver is. Because despite the fact that there's so much to dislike about him and the way that he views the world and frames the world for us, the way he sees the world through his eyes,
we still have a story that unfolds, and we still get really sort of profound insights into different ideas about communication. And the first of the themes that I wanted to look at, I suppose, is the patent difference between looking at something, you know, using your eyes to see it, and seeing something, which is in the metaphorical sense as well, understanding it and being able to decode what it is. You know, in Cathedral, you've got this guy who's very, very concerned with his own feelings, his own perceptions, and he admits that they're not very deep or profound. The act of looking in this story is sort of related to the physical use of your vision, but seeing is that deeper, more profound metaphorical idea of engaging on a new level of understanding something. And our narrator here, you know, he can look at things. He can look at his wife and coldly assess her. He can look at his house and coldly assess it. He can look at Robert when he arrives and coldly and sort of dispassionately assess what he sees using his eyes. But is he really seeing him? Does he really know his wife? Does he see his wife on that level? Does he see what Robert really is? Does he see the world at all? As we see later on, he's, by his own admission, not really interested necessarily in anything. He lacks the vocabulary to profoundly describe the cathedral, the central symbol that we'll come to later on. So the narrator is not blind, and yet he basically straight away assumes on the back of that he is a better person than Robert. He's superior in some way. Robert is deficient. His blindness, according to our man, leaves him sort of, as our narrator would assess it, definitely unable to make his wife Beulah happy or to have any kind of a normal life. Our narrator is certain that being able to look at something with your eyes is everything. He doesn't try to see beyond the overtly visual, beyond any surface appearance. And, you know, we get very much as we go on through the story, get that feeling that that's why maybe his life is the way it is. Maybe he is the shallow individual he is because he doesn't have that ability to see. Robert, even though he can't use his eyes in the way that the narrator can, he seems to see the narrator's wife in a way that the narrator does not. He seems to understand her. He seems to listen, and in that way that we use it, the phrase today, get her. Her reaction to both men is very interesting as well. She obviously has an awful lot of things that she wants to express. She spent the best part of a decade confiding in Robert via these tapes, more of which later on. She obviously wants to have that sort of communication, which I think our narrator refers to as sort of chit-chat when he listens to a little bit of the tape. But these are the type of small, perhaps unimportant, and yet profoundly important intimate details which she enjoys sharing. And she can't do that with him because he's such a shallow individual. So in this story, seeing, you know, properly seeing something is shown by Robert, and it's something that involves more than just using your eyes, I guess. Another theme that seems to be there is the idea of creativity and art as a means of getting that profound insight or understanding of something. The narrator, his wife, and Robert all find sort of a deeper level of insight or meaning in their lives through poetry, in the case of the narrator's wife, drawing, which is the kind of, I guess, climactic scene of the story, and storytelling, which is what they engage in and what connects them, even if it is about the chit-chat about Robert's journeys that he's made to get there. We're told by the narrator that his wife writes these poems. It's her attempt to mark important events. She obviously has that desire to communicate, to create, or to express her thoughts in that creative fashion, to make sense of the world, if you like, in that way. The deeply intimate description of how Robert touched her face stayed with her as a very, very profound experience, one in which she wanted to communicate to other people, or to certainly to make sense of it for herself. So she does it in the form of a poem. our main man, our narrator, he gets a little bit of insight at the end of the story when he draws the cathedral with Robert, that kind of shared experience. He gets to see that actually looking at it a bit deeper, you know, in that metaphorical way, and getting a little bit of deeper knowledge about yourself, deeper understanding of yourself by looking sort of inside yourself and trying to see a thing in a way that you haven't seen it before. And that's, you know, we all know these guys and gals who are surface beings, surface creatures, very interested in themselves and themselves only, and their perspective on the world only, and not interested in seeing anything on a deeper level. Even Robert, who is a bit more tuned in and clearly has to be because of the fact that he has this visual impairment, he seems to get something from that drawing experience. Obviously, he's, you know, going to get a rough idea from tracing his finger along the edges and getting a feel for what the shape might generally be. But it's more like he shares in whatever sort of awakening is happening with our narrator, that he is able to buzz off the fact that the narrator is having some sort of an epiphany, having some sort of a profound experience of deeper understanding. About just something as simple as that cathedral thing, about himself, about the world in general. Now, we have to remember that this story is recounted by our narrator, and that means that the actions are in the past. So you would like to think that this profound life lesson has changed him, but as he's telling the story, he's still getting his digs in. As he's telling the story, we wonder, don't we, you know, having read it now and looking back, how much has he learned? Because the filter of that deeper understanding does not necessarily seem to be applied to the way that he recounts the story, where he's always trying to get in a little comment or a defensive comment or says something which would say to us that maybe that was a very fleeting insight that he gleaned towards the end of the story. So quick word about the two most dominant symbols as far as I can see them. First of all, the audio tapes. We've spoken about those. Robert and the narrator's wife exchanged these. They obviously represent a sort of a deeper level of empathy, which they share, which has nothing to do with sight, vision. The narrator, you know, we get to hear what he thinks about the lack of sight. Beulah, the Robert's wife, he reckons must have had a terrible time because, you know, Robert couldn't see her. And again, we get to see this very surface level of understanding that he has about life. But the irony is that Robert did see Beulah in a way that the narrator has never really seen his own wife. You know, Robert's relationship with the narrator's wife is much deeper than the narrator's own with his wife. He doesn't seem to get that those tapes, those audio tapes, are intimate. They are proper communication, honest communication, deeper communication, the kind of thing which his marriage patently lacks. He talks about, doesn't he, how he sits up every night on his own, she goes to bed. You can tell the impatience in her voice. There are endless reports through the story, again, through the perception of the narrator, obviously, about how she flashes him all these dirty looks again and again and again. She's disappointed almost by everything that he says. So we know that this is not a relationship that's in a great place. And therefore, like I say, these audio tapes really profoundly kind of express this deeper level. They represent that deeper level of intimacy that you can get beyond just, you know, the visual, the surface level of things. And of course, it's quite interesting, though, at one stage Robert does say, you know, as he's sitting in the room chit-chatting with him, this is better than audio tapes, isn't it? You know, so again, you know, there are a couple of different levels, and again, it wouldn't be Carver if there wasn't a sort of a multi-layered depth to these sort of symbols. The cathedral itself is the other one that we should talk about. The narrator and Robert draw this cathedral at the end, which actually represents proper, truthful insight and vision, the ability to kind of see beyond what's on the surface and see the deeper meaning of something. Before the drawing, the narrator's worldview is very simple. He judges everything on that surface visual level. When he tries to describe, using words to describe the cathedral, he realizes he's incapable of doing so. He admits that he doesn't have the ability to do that. He can't communicate it. So his shallowness, for want of a better expression, is on display immediately. But more important than that, he tells us that the reason that he can't explain what the cathedral is because it has no meaning for him. He doesn't care about it. It's not important to him. And we know that what's important to him is, you know, a very small little selfish paradigm of existence. But when he takes the time to draw out the cathedral, even in that, you know, incredibly intimate way with Robert's hands guiding his, or Robert's hands, sorry, as he says, riding his, this is when the epiphany happens. This is when the moment of insight happens. He takes the time, like I say, to draw it out, to think about it, to see it in his mind's eye by, you know, closing his eyes specifically, adding details, you know, fleshing it out, adding the people, adding the buttresses and all these things. And he even does some of it with his eyes closed. And this is the really strong, powerful symbol for me. Okay, so he's experiencing life, if you like, as Robert. And yet he's also getting a deeper understanding and getting to see that there is life beyond the visual. There is meaning beyond the visual. And when the drawing is done, our narrator keeps his eyes shut, you know, because what he is seeing is much more important and affecting than anything he's ever seen with his eyes open. Carver doesn't really give us much here at the end of the story. He's not very specific, because again, the information is coming via this guy who's deeply unable to communicate himself and his ideas. But he says that at the end there, he didn't feel like he was inside anything. So there's this idea of, I don't know, a bizarre, unusual physicality to the experience, a sort of a weightlessness, like he's sort of drifting, like he's in some sort of a different place. He is having, like I say, this epiphany. And a cathedral is associated with worship and prayer and insight, whether you believe in religion or not. But that's the idea behind it. And it is in itself a tribute to something beyond whatever plane of existence that people are in. It's, you know, it's the idea behind it. It's this building that is a tribute to whatever God people believe in. And in the way that the cathedral offers that sort of, I don't know, place to find solace, by drawing it in the way that he did with Robert, partially with his eyes closed, and the unwillingness to open his eyes, it's so interesting. He doesn't want to let go of that feeling, because even though he doesn't understand what's happening is that he is attaining insight, and he's reaching a deeper place in terms of his own understanding of the world, being able to see beyond the immediately visual, and that's pretty profound. I think it's lovely that he chooses to keep his eyes closed at that end sequence, because what he's doing there is he is willfully going into that benighted state that he sort of sneered at all the way through the story, because that's how he perceived Robert to be, literally benighted, somehow impaired, somehow lesser. And yet at the end of the story, he willfully chooses to stay in that state. You know, he keeps telling us that he didn't open his eyes. He didn't want to open his eyes. And our man, who is, let's face it, not exactly the most eloquent, the way that he expresses what he's feeling, he says, "My eyes were still closed. I was in my house. I knew that. But I did not feel like I was inside anything. I didn't feel like I was inside anything." That's really interesting. It makes us think about how he feels like he's on some sort of different transcendent plane right there in that moment. But the last line of the story, I know it seems underwhelming when you hear it for the first time. When I read it for the first time, I was like, okay. And you go back then, you read it again, or you listen to it again, which obviously I'm going to be doing for this, even if I hadn't done it already. And that last line is so interesting, because the last line is, "It's really something," I said. And like I said, this guy is not articulate. This guy is not capable of saying to Robert, "Dude, what you've done for me here is open up my capacity to experience the world. What you've done for me here is allow me to understand that there is a level of sight, a level of seeing that goes beyond the visual, that there is a level of seeing that is understanding, that is common experience, that is shared insight. Our man can't say that. So our man says, it's really something. And that's about as close as Robert's going to get to thanks, I guess, from this ironically benighted soul. Now, I hope I haven't gone on too long there, but I did want to give a little bit of feedback so that you could maybe reframe the story yourself afterwards or go back and listen to it again. It does bear repeated listenings, as all of the ones that we pick out here do, because we're not going to bring you good stories. We're going to bring you great stories. Now, we had a lost episode, which is why I was talking about The Great Fluctuation by the Stargatsky brothers. And I can't even begin to tell you how saddened I am. Myself and Neil had the most wonderful chat about that. And the gremlins of Skype decided to visit with us. It's the first time anything like that has ever happened to me, really. So I'm not going to go on about it too much. It's unfortunate. It's very, very annoying. It's very upsetting. I had been bigging the episode up. I had told you guys it was coming up. And then all of a sudden it just wasn't there. The story, however, is read and recorded. And when Neil and I feel like there's a suitable amount of distance that we won't be repeating ourselves, or you said that the last time, or did you say that the last time, we will do it again. Now, I wanted to just get an episode out because I wanted to get an episode out. It didn't 100% tie in with Neil's schedule this week because he's having a bit of a holiday for himself, and it's well earned it is. But he is going to be back with me next week, and next week we are going to do a real classic called The Most Dangerous Game by Richard Connell. I loved this one because it is such an old-fashioned yarn, like just a proper yarn. And, you know, you can kind of see where it's going from minute one, but that doesn't in any way lessen it. And lessen its impact. It's, like I said, a good old-fashioned rollicking adventure story. But, and the reason I've chosen it, obviously, is not because it's one of those ones that gets put on lists as the best stories ever. No, it's not because of that. It's because there are loads of places that Neil and I can take it. So I've sent it to him. I've recorded it and edited it. It's good to go. And we will be meeting, like I say, within the week, I think, to record our chat on that one. And that means there'll be another episode come along hot in the heels of this one because, what the hell, it's summer and we might as well do what we can. Look, it's very important to me to say a couple of things at the end here. Some of you are just going to skip it. That's fine. Go ahead and do that and we'll talk to you at the next one. But I want to say thank you to all the people who have decided to give one-off donations or who have signed up to be sustaining supporters of the show. What I am referring to now is producers. And that's exactly what you are. And I really, really, really want to express my gratitude to those who have signed up. Like I said, there are those who will sign up and listen to the stories and then bugger off. And they get in and get out for a monthly subscription of one-off. That's fine. Whatever. I look, the idea is if you decide to become a subscriber for the month, that, you know, so you can get access to that extra stuff that's there. It's not just for that. It's because you are actually choosing to support the show. And the vast majority who have done that are doing that. And I'm immensely grateful to you. I hope that we can grow this by a factor of many, many, many more in the days and months and weeks and year to come, because that is absolutely my goal, is to do this full time and make this into a show that, you know, has loads of offshoots where we look at novels, where we look at non-fiction, where we can pull things apart on an even deeper level on a more regular basis. That is the plan long term. And I just want to say, instead of begging anybody for anything, I want to say thanks to the people who are constantly sustaining, supporting, and the people who have given one-off donations. You're absolute legends, and I really, really appreciate you immensely. So thank you for that. We will be back, like I said, myself and Neil, with The Most Dangerous Game by Richard Connell. That was Cathedral by Raymond Carver. And I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, tell someone about it. Can't hurt, right? Talk to you soon.